This is Champagne Sharks, episode 23. This is T. I'm on Twitter at Ricky Rawls, RickyRawls. And with me is co-host D Mills.
Hey, everybody. It's D Mills. That's MD Mills 79 at MD Mills 79 on Twitter. Well, T, we're together again on another Saturday, and on another Saturday, all hell looks like is breaking loose, huh?
I know. This is like a weekend tradition right now, man. The new rally. I bet you while this episode is going on, something wild is going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I bet you. This for people who don't know, especially because, you know, people could be listening to this weeks or months later, you know, this is something that's going to be up for a while. As we're speaking, there is yet another protest and rally going on in Boston. And it's trending on Twitter under the hashtag Fight Supremacy. And there's also another hashtag that says Boston Free Speech Rally. And I just did a quick cursory background search on it, and I will put it into the show notes. I have a couple of CNN links, but I will explain what I just read. I think you might have just read the same articles, but from what I understand, there was this thing planned called a free speech rally, and it seemed to be basically, and I'm stealing D's term, so I want to give him credit. He said it's basically the Unite the Right rally, but for the Ben Shapiro type of conservative racist, like the ones who like dog whistles and, you know, the respectable racists. Like they want to take racism back from the uncouth heathens and, you know, bring racism back into the Fox News, Never Trump, National Review, Ben Shapiro wing of racism. So this is like, they're there. And I went to the free speech rallies Facebook page, and on there they're all about, yeah, this is about free speech, white nationalists. And by white nationalists, they mean open white nationalists, because covert white nationalists, from what I can tell on this Facebook page, are still very welcome. But it is basically all about, hey, KKK, don't come. We're about free speech. And then on the Facebook page, it says stuff like Ku Klux Klan, Antifa, and Black Lives Matter are terrorist groups. So they're using this kind of fake moral equivalence, but, you know, it's really still just the same old. This is basically a Unite the Right rally that Fox News personalities and right-wing talk radio people can show their face at, you know? And what they officially say is, according to CNN, organizers for the Boston event have invited, quote, liberals, conservatives, traditionalists, classic liberals, classical liberals, which, you know, basically means like those Austrian economics guys, those right-wing neoliberals, and Trump supporters. So they actually say Trump supporters among people who are invited to come, or anyone else who enjoys the right to free speech. Those are the people who are invited to this rally. And I find it interesting that they put Trump supporters as the final invitees. And they are claiming that open hate groups, which they list as KKK, white nationalists, and Black Lives Matter, which is funny because I don't think Black Lives Matter would want to march with them. You know, those are people who are not invited. And a coalition of left-leaning groups, in anticipation of this free speech rally, organized their own counter-protest and started it an hour earlier. So this counter-protest is called the Fight Supremacy Rally, and it's organized by a coalition of mostly left-leaning groups and activists, such as the Black Lives Matter movement. And it seems like Black Lives Matter Cambridge in Boston is the one that is one of the main organizers of it. I'm not sure who else is behind the Fight Supremacy.
I see Boston March. Antifa is
Are you able to find who's behind the fight supremacy thing, D?
No, so far the only real link is to that Cambridge chapter of Black Lives Matter. That's the only thing that I've been able to.
Do you mind discussing that link? Because you go to fightsupremacy.org and it redirects you to another site. Do you want to talk about that, D? Because I think it's pretty interesting.
So basically what ended up happening is T and I were going over some of the stories this morning, and we noticed the fight supremacy hashtag. We came across a link to a website, fightsupremacy.org. And then what ended up happening is when you go to fightsupremacy.org, it redirects you to a website called, I'm bringing it up really quickly. Give me 1 second. Fightsupremacy.org. Yeah, this is really interesting. And bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, we're this is all happening kind of in real time. Okay, it redirects you to a website called youcaring.com, which is a crowdfunding website. So you go to find out more information about this fightsupremacy.org, and it redirects you to a crowdfunding site, which is the Black Lives Matter Strategic Resistance and Response Fund. So basically, it's a link to like a GoFundMe type of situation. That's all it really is.
Yeah, and they made a ton of money already. I don't know how long this thing has been up. I'm trying to look. They had a $15,000 goal. They already made $45,245. So they made three times their goal. So this has been
a little bit over 1,100, almost 1,200 donors.
Oh, you know, it's interesting. If you look, there's four tiers of goals. They had a tier one goal. It says $6,250. Then it's crossed out and it says goal reached. And they changed it to a tier two goal. And that was $10,500. Goal reached, crossed out. Tier three goal, $12,000. Goal reached, crossed out. So now it's tier four goal, $15,000, and they made $45,000. And it seems like at this point they just gave up on changing the tiers, like, you know, because they just keep breaking
their
fundraising goals. Now, they have changed it like four times already.
So it looks like it went beyond even their wildest expectations.
Oh yeah, so this has been kind of a boon for them. This free speech, respectable racist rally. This thing has really I found a list of the groups. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I found a list of the groups coordinating it. It's the counter protest, the one that seems to have eclipsed the originally planned one, is organized by Violence in Boston, Angie Camacho, I'm not sure who she is, Black Lives Matter Network, Black Lives Matter Cambridge, and Black Lives Matter Boston. So three different types of Black Lives Matter groups. Someone named Angie Camacho and something called Violence in Boston, which I'm not going to guess what it is, because I might get it wrong.
I'm guessing that this group is behind the fight supremacy hashtag, because what's interesting is when you go to this website that takes you to the crowdfunding site, let me sip some more coffee really quick.
Okay. In the meantime, I'm just going to say I found who Angie Camacho is. She's a candidate for Boston City Council, and she's pretty young. So she's like a very young politician. It's nice to see someone this young being civically engaged. I don't know what her politics are, but she's one of the protesters. So, I mean, one of the people behind this rally. She's running for a city council. And
describes herself as an Afro Latina.
Oh, she does.
Yeah, I'm looking at her Twitter account.
Mm-hmm. So maybe she's not Dominican, because it's not very easy for Dominican people
to. Yeah, they have a problem describing themselves as Afro.
if she's Dominican, calling herself Afro Latina, she's especially forward thinking.
Yeah, exactly. So she's probably Puerto Rican or something. I would imagine. Or half Puerto Rican or something like that.
Or maybe she's just, you know, a Dominican person who just, you know, wants to. Because to be fair, I joke around, but there are a lot of Dominican people who are trying to go against that old way. Like, they kind of realize this is bullshit. You know, I'll be fair. There are a lot of Dominican people who are like, we have to change this anti-blackness and Dominican society. I mean, there's by far not enough of them, but maybe she's one of those.
Yeah, could be. So there's a lot of interesting characters involved with this. I wanted to steer it back really quick to that hashtag, though. The hashtag fight supremacy.
Yeah.
I noticed that on the website, they actually, their moniker actually has, it says white supremacy fight, and then they have the white portion of it crossed out, and then it just says fight supremacy, now is the time to resist. And I find it interesting that, because what we're really discussing is white supremacy, but for some reason they chose to go with a more ambiguous term, like fight supremacy.
Yes.
And what's interesting about that is I was going through Twitter, just following the hashtag earlier today, and one of the more well-known alt-right racist Twitter trolls, this guy named Ricky Vaughn, he actually tweeted out that hashtag as well, because it's ambiguous enough for people like him to actually co-opt it, which is what they kind of like to do with any kind of left or liberal. I'm not going to say left, but any kind of liberal terminology that comes up that's ambiguous enough for them to co-opt.
Yeah, yes. And before you continue, I just want to give two examples. Fake news, which Donald Trump totally weaponized against liberals in such a comical way. And then the alt-left, like liberals created this term, the alt-left, to kind of demonize and punch to the left against like the Antifa types. And now Donald Trump has like used that and weaponized that. And yeah, those are two examples of what you're talking about.
So I'm looking at it now. First of all, it's the number one trending thing on Twitter, this fight supremacy. But I really don't understand why they even Tito Jackson is tweeting about fight supremacy. Says this is what resistance looks like. Hashtag fight supremacy.
Yeah.
Hashtag, oh my God, Boston resist.
That's too funny. And I get what you're saying. It's a kind of term that I can totally see the alt-right and the Trump types just co-opting and turning into a phrase. Like, you know, it's not enough to be a white supremacist. You have to fight white genocide. You have to be a fight supremacist. Like, I bet you that's going to happen. I'm so ready for that. Like, it's just so ambiguous. And you made a good point before we started the show. You were saying that it seems to be a way to kind of, like they do with everything else, make it an umbrella for everybody, you know, like, by making it fight supremacy. Anything else I'm not going to be surprised about, they start using it to argue against black male patriarchy. You know, because by changing it to fight supremacy, now you just fight anybody that you can call supremacist. Supremacist. So if it's not just white supremacy, why not say, hey, let's fight black male patriarchy. Let's fight misogyny. You know, it's gonna get very diluted. Like, just fight anything that's keeping people down. Let's fight transphobia. Let's fight this, that. And I mean, not saying there's nothing, anything wrong with fighting any of these things, but I just noticed we don't really have any black causes anymore. Like for example, we have all these umbrella causes, right? But gay people, when they want, they can switch back to their gay groups.
Gay groups and gay rights groups,
feminists can go back to their feminist groups, Latinos can go to their La Razas and Latina groups, but what we have black people, we have our umbrella groups, then we have our black groups, which are still umbrella groups.
Yeah. Umbrellas within the
umbrella. We have umbrellas within umbrellas, like, you know, like
we're all standing underneath a canopy. And we have umbrellas underneath the canopy. We have open umbrellas.
Yeah. It's like Russian dolls, but with umbrellas instead of, like, you know, those nesting dolls. We have like nesting umbrellas, you know. And then within the umbrellas, right, under our black umbrella, we're just fighting each other. Like, hey, you're erasing black women. And I see things now. Like, I saw black queer women getting mad at black queer men for using their black male patriarchy to erase the queer women. And then the straight women, I saw this argument on Twitter, the straight black women were siding with the black queer women to say, we're tired of you black gay men using. So I'm like, wait. And then the black gay men were like, hey, wait a minute. When did we become
you
the enemy?
You use us.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like such a fucking mess. You know what I mean? And
it's
even before then.
It really.
Yeah. Even before then, we had civil rights. Like, what is a civil right? Like, why isn't that just fucking black rights? Like, but you can't say. So even before we had this overt divisiveness, right? We had, back when we had a so-called black movement, it was just civil rights, because, you know, and then everyone else was able to get in under it. And now you have affirmative action for, you have white women as the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action. Because when it's civil rights, it could be about anybody. If it's black rights, then affirmative action becomes a very specific thing. You know, it's so comical. But I kind of see why. I just want to get this last thing in. I can kind of see why, because the last time we actually tried to have an unambiguously black movement that wasn't trying to be an umbrella for everyone and that wasn't trying to have infighting, that was the Black Power movement. And they destroyed the fuck out of that. They gunned them down in the streets. Yeah. They COINTELPRO'd them out of existence. They have us so scared.
Imprisoned them.
Imprisoned them, broke their spirit. I mean, they have us so scared to ever try to do something as unambiguously black and united as that ever again, I think.
No, I agree 100%. And, you know, we do it to ourselves as well. I mean, there's a concentrated effort by black people to use these ambiguous terms. I see it a lot. We were just arguing with somebody the other day. There's a guy on Twitter. I think he's deleted a lot of what he had initially said. But we were discussing the issue with Barack Obama not doing specific things targeted toward African-Americans in terms of policy, executive orders, et cetera. So this one guy was saying, well, what specifically black thing did you want the president to do that was within his constitutional authority? So right there, the guy is giving the president of the United States, who's issued all kinds of executive orders, who's signed all kinds of bills and laws into existence that strengthen gay rights, that strengthen the rights of other minority groups, that gives specific funds to like Jewish groups, things like that. He signed the Blue Lives Matter bill. I don't think it was called that, but basically it was a bill that gave police officers additional protections.
Yeah, yeah. It was unofficially called Blue Lives Matter, kind of like how the Affordable Care Act was unofficially called Obamacare.
And so we have examples after examples of him giving non-ambiguous support to distinct minority groups. But then when it comes to black people, even black people are fine with the ambiguity. They don't want to demand specific concrete actions to be taken to support the group. Because like you said, I honestly think that these people are just afraid, man. They're afraid of white backlash. That's the only thing that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and you know what's crazy is how so many things that he's done that kind of went under the radar for other groups. You know, everyone says, oh, this is what a lot of these bougie black liberals, Obama apologists love saying. They're like, Obama's the president of all America, not just black America. You know, they love saying that. But meanwhile, Obama earmarked in 2015 $12 million for Holocaust survivors in America.
Right.
That's right.
Perfect example.
Yeah, yeah. He did a couple of things for natives, Native Americans. He I can't remember exactly what it was, but he got them a ton of. Oh yeah. Under Obama, he did a nearly $1 billion settlement
with
hundreds of Native American tribes. That's in 2015. 2016, $492 million by the Obama administration to 17 American Indian tribes. And
so that's half a billion dollars.
Yes, yes. A lot of things happened. And I'm like, do you black people, do you black bougie liberals, do you read anything in the news about Obama besides his latest dab or his latest Spotify playlist or his latest cheap pandering thing that he's doing to kind of pretend that he's an American black. Like, when I say American, I mean like descended from U.S. slaves. I mean, he's American. He was born in America, but you know, he kind to me kind of co-opts a lot of U.S. slave descended black culture.
He knows how to.
That's not really authentic to him, you know. To kind of act like he
is. Right. He knows. Yeah. He knows how to do it. You know. He knows how to mimic certain traits of blackness that a lot of mainstream black people react in a positive way to. You know. He knows exactly what to say, how to move, what songs to sing in order to trigger a certain reaction that he wants to bring out from a lot of black people.
Yeah, yeah.
And something else that, is really crazy to me. And so one of the things that I like to do when we have these discussions with these liberal bourgeois blacks and the ones who are really just kind of really act as arms of the Democratic Party. When I say Democrat, I mean the mainstream Democratic Party.
The establishment wing.
Is when they start doing that, the establishment wing. When they start doing that, you know, I just let them go ahead and keep saying all the reasons why he couldn't do specific things for black people. And then I hit them with, okay, he couldn't do this because of this. He couldn't do that. He couldn't earmark any specific funds for black people. What did you vote for him for? If he can't do anything, then what the hell did you vote for him for? And they can never say anything.
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes they do answer, and the answer is even more damning than not answering. Because when I've asked that, sometimes they say, well, he's a symbol, and we need a symbol because he shows black people they can become president. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. If you're saying that he can't do anything, then what's the point of black people being inspired to become president? If it's if you're saying that it's an impotent job that, you know, a black person can't use. Yeah. If he's saying it's a toothless job that a black person can't use to win rights for black people, then why should we have a symbol that inspires young black people of intelligence and capability to get into that job? Like, you know, you would think you want to keep them out of that job. Like if you're saying this job is used, and I just say, here's something else that they say. It's so stupid. This get on my nerves. I want to be a professional podcaster and, you know, sound very reasoned, but I just get flustered sometimes because when we talk about them, they just drive me nuts. But, you know, let me stay calm. This is the one that pisses me off the most. And tell me if you've ever seen this one, D. Somebody had an article a while back, a couple of years back, and it said Obama has been a disappointment because fighting racism should have been his number one priority. And it's a black guy that wrote this article, and all these blabbity blacks, these blue check BuzzFeed bourgeois Negroes, started going in on the writer of this article, and they're like, how dare you put the onus on a black man to stop racism? You know, you sound like a white supremacist, and black people didn't create racism, so black people shouldn't fight racism. And besides, you know, he's a president of all America, not just black America, and, you know, you should talk to white people and get them to stop racism. It's not a black person's job. And plus, white people aren't going to let a black person stop racism. You know, he's hamstrung. And all things they're saying, so I'm like, wait a minute. All of you guys are into Black Lives Matter. You're into all these things. If you think it's not a black person's job to fight racism, then why are you even in these activist groups? Like, you know, like, you're not even having any type of consistency here. You're just trying to say whatever you can say to win the argument or to just keep, you know, your symbols alive. It makes no sense what you're saying. But what you're saying then invalidates Malcolm X, invalidates the Black Power movement, invalidates Martin Luther King. Like, why did Martin Luther King speak out against racism? And then some people responded with, oh, well, you understand, they were independent activists, which still changes the story because according to them, no black people, it's a job to start racism. But it's not splitting hairs. It goes, oh, they're an activist, but he's the president. And as a president, you know, he has less room. They won't let a black guy fight racism. So I'm like, okay, so then by your own logic, we're better off getting a white president. Because if you're saying that a black person is not the job to fight racism, so that even when they get in that job, it's working against them being black, then you just made an argument to just have good white allies as president and keep black people out. And then when you say that, they go to the same point. Yeah, but we need the symbol. Okay, so the circular logic is we need a symbol, a black symbol, so that he can get into a job that by virtue of him being black, he'll be too impotent to perform because he's black and it's not a black person's job to fight racism. And having that black person in the job that he can't use to fight racism because he's black will be great because he'll be a symbol that will inspire other young, smart, intelligent black people to try to get into that job, which you just said is a job that black people can't use to fight racism. And that will help black people. And I'm like, these are our best and brightest. These are the people who are doing all the writing and all the major prestige medias who have made themselves the voice of black people. Yep. We're fucked. We're beyond.
We are fucked, dude. But that shows me that they don't really want to do the work to get free. They don't want to fight. You know what I mean? They just want nice symbolic victories. They want to say my president was black. They want to surf swag on the White House lawn. This is the kind of bullshit that we're up against, man. And I don't know what it's going to take to eradicate that mentality in the community, but we're going to have to figure something out fast, because these neo-Nazis, these alt-right guys, they're not fucking around, man.
Please explain swag on the White House lawn for people who don't know, because, you know, a lot of times we have a lot of inside baseball Twitter stuff. So please explain that for people who don't know what you're talking about.
I guess, what do you want me to explain, like, what the swag surf is or what they did on the White House? Like, what do you mean? Okay. So, as I understand it, I've never done this shit in my life, so please forgive me if my explanation is not extensive enough. But from what I understand, swag surfing is basically a new dance that black people have come up with, where a crowd of us get together and... we put our arms in the air and sway back and forth or to the side or whatever. And so a bunch of people went to the White House as in the closing days of the Obama administration, and they took a selfie or a video of them doing this swag surf thing on the White House lawn. And then it became a hashtag.
Yes. And it was a weird time in black culture, because it was that era of 2016 where, for some reason, there was just a new dance coming out like every week, you know. You know, there was like the dab, the Millie Rock, and there was so many dances coming.
The Running Man,
many dances coming out that they even made a song. They just combined all the dances into one song, like, you know. Yeah, and the Swag Surf, you know, I think was one of them. So Obama had this.
Did that become a challenge? Was that a challenge?
I think all of them became a challenge. I just tried to mute all that stuff because I just don't get.
I did too. That's why I say, please forgive me if my explanation is not on point, not 100% on point, but you guys get it. You know, basically, here it is. Insert whatever fucking dance challenge that you guys know of that happened in 2016. Just say they all got together and did the Running Man challenge on the White House lawn. Or the Millie Rock on the White House. Exactly. It's all the same shit.
It's all interchangeable.
Got together on
the White. But actually, you know what? You know something? Let's go into this, because this is such fuckery. This is worth elaborating on. Okay. Now, this is some Nero fiddling while Rome burns shit. This is like October of 2016. We're a month and 5 days away from Trump winning the election, and all these bougie liberal intersectional media academic industrial complex people were just expecting it's a seamless transition into another 8 years of impotent peacocking that they call social activism these days, you know? So they weren't really taking the Trump thing seriously. It was just all these people just ready to just have the same type of climate they had under Obama, except with a a female lean under Hillary. You know, they just thought, okay, we're just going to transition to the same type of symbolic bullshit, but it's a woman's turn. So, you know, it'll be a little bit more female, but all these black people just thought they were just going to have the same continued access, the same continued platforms, the same continued access to power. They have this thing, it's called SXSL. It's I forget what it was, but it's some kind of thing that they had at the Obama White House, where they got a whole bunch of activists and academics and everything to show up to the White House. And they did this thing called the Million Swag Surf Movement. This is what our best and brightest were doing, right? And let me read this article, right? This is a month before Obama is coming in. BET.com. Watch, the swag surf officially made it to the White House lawn. Subheading, yet another reason why President Obama is the GOAT. GOAT meaning greatest of all time. So basically, he let a bunch of middle class and upper middle class and college educated black people do a hood dance on the White House lawn at an event where they're supposed to be, doing serious things. And this is what makes him the greatest of all time. This is what we demanded out of him. You know, he's giving $12 million to Holocaust survivors, $500,000 to Native Americans, but he lets us swag surf on the lawn. And he's the greatest president that we had. You know, thank you. He shit talks the idea of reparations to black people to Ta-Nehisi Coates in his last month of power. If you read Ta-Nehisi Coates' article about Obama's last month of power, and he throws us a big party that Dave Chappelle talked about on his Saturday Night Live appearance, we know, where he lets all the black people show up and have a big gala, you know, and this is a couple of weeks before Trump won. And, you know, he uses symbolic things in parties. But let me finish the article. Right now, there is an incredible video of a group of people doing the swag surf on the White House lawn. At first glance, it may appear that the video is just a fun representation of how cool President Obama is. However, after some careful research, it's clear that the dance that occurred on the South Lawn is creating a movement larger than we know. Yesterday, the White House held this music and activism event, South Lawn. So, you know, in Austin, there's this music and activism event called South by Southwest. They had South by South Lawn because, you know, Obama's always so cool. You know, he makes Spotify playlists. So, you know, hey, no other president would be cool enough to have an event named after South by Southwest, you know, but whatever. Yesterday, the White House held this music and activism event, South by South Lawn, a take on South by Southwest. The festival included inspirational talks, music, and a noteworthy discussion about climate change moderated by President Obama, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Catherine Hayhoe. However, the moment that has everyone realizing how truly cool our president is. Let me repeat that. However, the moment that has everyone realizing how truly cool our president is, because that's what matters, how cool he is, occurred when Jason Mowat, the creator of Million Swag Surf, and several individuals did the swag surf on the lawn. Then it shows a video of them doing the swag surf. And the guy Jason tweets under the video, "Bruh, we just swag surfed at the White House," and is a crying emoji. "Support Million Swag Surf." And it gives the Twitter account for Million Swag Surf. And then someone responded, "Third term? God, we gonna miss Obama, huh?" You know, and then it continues, Million Swag Surf is a movement with the goal of bringing awareness to bone marrow cancer. According to Mowat,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah.
So at this event, they talked, I'm going to continue with the article. So at this event, they talked about climate change. They had a movement to spread awareness about bone marrow cancer. And you mentioned something else happening there. But the biggest takeaways were it was a music festival, inspirational talks, climate change.
Yes, and we're a month from getting Donald Trump and we're a month away from all these fucks never being invited again. For like if these guys now try to get within 100 feet of the White House. He's gonna do like a fucking Montgomery Burns, like release the hounds on these guys. Like, you know what I'm saying? They just wasted 8 years of access to a black president doing. They wasted eight years of access to a black president doing nothing up until the last month. These people are fiddling like Nero while Rome burns. They're doing swag surfing. Like, I mean, they're just so sure, and they were just ready for Hillary to come, and then when Hillary came in during the inauguration, they were going to come in and just dab on the White House lawn this time.
They thought the party was going to continue.
Yes, they thought the party was going to continue. They just thought it was going to be just more access, more unlimited budgets for think pieces that just talk about the same five things over and over again. Okay, okay, but let me just finish the article just to get it over with, because I want to get the pain over with. Although Million Swag Surf is a charitable cause, it's certainly very different from the usual nonprofit organizations that past presidents have hosted. It's incredible that President Obama allowed such an innovative and relevant movement to be a part of his festival. For the last time, Mr. President, please don't go. That's how it ends. And you know something? In October 2016, yes, he has a fucking Million Swag Surf on his front lawn. But you know what happened after he left office? He was doing a real life fucking windsurf with Richard Branson, the billionaire. I mean, he's not thinking of you guys now. Like, the only surf he's doing is with the virgin billionaire, Richard Branson, with sunglasses on, like, you know, taking pics like a GQ spread or some kind of Condé Nast Traveler spread.
Just to I wanted to pick up on something that you mentioned in the article that said that past presidents have hosted various events. I'm noticing here that one of the events that it's an annual reception for the month of Ramadan. So that's a very important month in the religion of Islam that they host every year. And they said for the first time in years, for the first time in 20 years, the White House has passed on hosting a Ramadan dinner. So, but that's a very important Muslim holiday, and they celebrate that. Well, I don't want to say celebrate, but I'm imagining that a lot of political discourse and action happens during those annual receptions. So you see the contrast. They're there to take care of business, and it's something that they've done every year for 20 years. And this thing that Obama did with the swag, hosting the swag surfing thing, was a one-off situation. And it was the first time that he did it in the entire 8 years of his presidency. So that says a lot for what he's all about and what the people who were basically kissing his ass in that article talking about don't stay. It shows how short-sighted and impotent these people really are.
Don't go, you mean?
Don't go. Yeah. Yeah. That really right there says a lot to me right there. Amazing.
Oh yeah, yeah. And you know what's funny? You know, they put a link to Million Swag Surf website, you know, in the tweet, and I looked and they've done 5 tweets since then.
Oh wow. Since that so it's already a dead movement.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you look at the Twitter timeline and there's tumbleweeds floating through the timeline.
So like, I imagine they got their money. They built on the moment, they got their donation funds, and you know, they're gonna move on to whatever the next hustle is.
Yeah, and I also think there's just like there's a lot of people who were kind of carved out little spaces for themselves and their little sub movements that weren't really doing anything that mattered so much in the big picture as far as black politics go, that would just expect to just continue to hustle. Like he probably just start under Hillary, he probably just continues similar access or whatever. Like, I think a lot of these people, I think another reason why it stopped is not just because they took the money and ran. I think it's just that the money dried up. Like, under Trump, where are you going to go? Like, first of all, the liberals right now, because liberals are very craven, all they want to do is win. When they're winning, they'll entertain you. You know, when they're winning, they're like, hey, you know, hey, Negroes, come here, give us some votes, you know. But
right
now it's like, okay, Negroes, you didn't really come through. And now I want to talk about working white working class. And we think we lost because of you. We're going to just lay off you for a while. We're not going to fuck with you too hard right now. So a lot of these people are trying to figure out how to pick up the pieces and where to go. Not just black people, but there's a lot of like white liberals too. Like they're trying to rebrand. Hillary herself is trying to figure out what her next move is. You know what I mean? So I think a lot of these people who had this access.
Is that what you think?
Yeah.
Access?
Yeah, yeah. The access or, you know, just black people were pretty trendy under Obama. Like, you know, there were a lot of actually, there's a very good tweet that came out after Trump won that I think is very good because it captures everything. It's by this guy, Randy G-Dub. Very funny dude. He's the guy that did the post office hoax. Remember that post office hoax that the ballots?
That was so fucking funny.
That dude is so fucking funny. Yeah, we were all jumping in on it, but that's a whole different story. But he put a tweet on November 9th, 2016, at the election, and it was so prescient. He said, "Dems are going to look themselves in the mirror, take a deep breath, and tell themselves, we got to get more racist." So you know, these liberals, you know, as soon as they lose, all that solidarity is going to kind of go out the window, and they kind of realize, okay, having a bunch of black people swag surf wherever is going to just further alienate, you know, these white working class people that we need to because to them, you know, they won't admit it, but they think of white working class as synonymous with racist, mm-hmm. you know, so they don't want to alienate them. So I think that's probably part of the reason why a lot of these things that were kind of popping under Obama, a lot of these mini movements or mini initiatives or mini grifts or hustles, it just kind of dried up. Like, you know, these people, a lot of these black people don't know how to rebrand. Look how quiet the intersectionals are, like on Twitter. Remember how many think pieces they used to have, like crazy? All the prestige media profiles on Feminista Jones.
Yeah, about two years ago, that was a huge thing with them. Now it seems like they only pop up when something of large group interest happens, like this Charlottesville riot that happened last week, or whatever tragedy pops up, you know, then they'll figure out a way to kind of mix in their feminist issue agendas or what have you. Just like with this Charlottesville thing. Go ahead.
Yeah. They're fighting for diminishing scraps. Like, you know what I mean? Before there was like a buffet table and everybody was eating. Now they just gave them like just one. They took all the leftovers from the buffet table, just threw them all into one aluminum foil tin and just, you know, threw it in the backyard and said, okay, you guys just fight for this. And they're all just kind of fighting for the little bit of space that's left. That's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, I mean, because I think what you said is very true. I mean, because if you even look at, I'm not even going to put her name out there to give her any shine, but if you just look at last week during the Charlottesville situation, there was one very prominent Twitter black feminist that I think it was Lady Gaga that came out and asked, you know, black people, what can non-racist whites do to support you? And the one person said, you can use your celebrity access to denounce R. Kelly publicly.
Yes. Yes. You know, and the person he's not naming is Jamila Lemieux.
Okay.
because the reason I'm just throwing the name out there is because I'm going to post a link to a thread about it. So,
yeah, okay.
So we might as well.
Okay. Cool. No problem. So she tweets that out as what one of the biggest celebrities in the world can do. You have your moment, right? You say, okay, what can I do to address your concerns? What can I do? And what you tweet out is she can attack another black male for something that he was found not guilty of that happened 20 some odd years ago or whatever, however long ago it was. And, you know, I just find it amazing that they will hijack any significant amount of attention in order to bring attention to whatever their agenda is at the time. Yeah. Like even this you caring crowdfunding thing, if you scroll down and kind of read the material, it's talking, it veers into black, queer, and LGBT. It says, we encourage those who can to donate directly to local black and queer organizations and BIPOC, whatever that is, victims of white supremacy in your areas. So right there, you know, they managed to bring that into the fold. And Yeah, I just think it's amazing how, like you said, the attention is drying up, the resources are drying up, so they're battling for those last little bit of table scraps, and pretty soon, you know, it's just going to get to the point where it's just like you open up the refrigerator and there's nothing in there but, you know, a half container and a bottle of baking soda. They're going to be
a condiment bottle, but one of those condiment bottles where it's all dried up on the sides, and you have to scrape it. We have to scrape it with a knife.
Yeah, it's like.
Yeah, putting mustard flakes with a knife, moldy bread. They're gonna, this
on your sandwich,
man. I could go on and on. You're right. When you look at this thing, it has so many things going on it on this you caring site. Like, we're just so unfocused. Like on every level of Black organization, like we're just always multitasking in a terrible way. Like we don't really have any type of things that just are focused on helping Black people. Even if we do, like 10 minutes in, somebody's bringing up, well, what about this? Or why are you ignoring this? And that Jamila Lemieux thing is like a perfect example. You know, it's just, first off, they love having the ear of white celebrity allies because they're just always so aspirational as far as like getting bigger platforms and stuff. Like, why even should Black people even be explaining things to Lady Gaga? Like, you know, she's not stupid. She's rich. Just go, come on, figure it out. Like, why?
I think somebody actually did say that too.
Someone did say that. But you know, these people are just like that. When Lena Dunham and what's her name, Amy Schumer, said something that, you know, offensive to Black people with Odell Beckham and, you know, and that whole controversy. They said, hey, guys, we're ready to listen. Please teach us how to not be racist. And all these people who were just dragging them suddenly were all falling over each other like, hey, let me be the one to tell you. Let me tell you. And then they chose a Black man. And I'm convinced this was insidious, but
this was 100% them.
I'm very conspiratorial, but they went and picked a Black man. I think he might be a straight Black man, but they said, you Black man, his name is, I think he goes by XLNB, I think it's Xavier Burgess, they're like, hey, he was one of the people doing a rant, and he was getting all these props for his dragging rant. He was dragging them and doing those educate the white person threads. And then Lena Dunham jumped into his thread and goes, this is a great thread. Let's talk more so you can educate me in private and DM me. And then he dropped his whole radical speech. He's like, yeah, great. Let's DM.
Let's have lunch.
Let's do it. And then, yeah, Amy Schumer jumped in. She's like, me too. Yeah. Let's DM together. So it says, okay, we'll DM. Once that happened, oh my gosh,
all
hell broke loose. They all lost it. They were like, wait a minute, why is he getting the chance to talk to the famous white ladies and not us? And suddenly there were think pieces coming up by the Black feminists that he got to talk to them. I'm like, wait a minute, aren't you supposed to be dragging these people?
We had a bunch of erasure artists.
A bunch of erasures, a bunch of threads. And I actually interacted with some of these people. I was like, why are you putting such a premium on talking to someone that you claim is racist and you hate? You should be trying to get her out the paint. You should be trying to organize a boycott of her show if you hate her so much, or try to, like, when you put all this stuff and then suddenly just make it, you just gave her all the importance back again and made her matter all over again by changing the conversation to fighting about access to her. Like, why do you even care? You should be saying fuck both of them, get both of them out of paint. So then he ends up apologizing, but he still keeps his access with her. He does an article, and the article comes out about him, about how good he is at, you know, schooling white people. I'm going to put a link to the article. So
wait. The dude that went and met with Schumer and the other chick, he wrote an article about himself.
No, he didn't write an article. There was an article. Oh, okay. There was an article about him, though. It was in Hollywood.
It was written.
Yes. I'm going to put it in the show notes. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send it to you right now. Click this link, bro.
We're blocked by this guy, by the way. There's a little inside baseball. T and I and Mike, we all share information with each other. And from time to time, you know, I'm trying to show him something and he says, oh, I can't see that. I'm blocked by this person. Or he's trying to show me something and we're blocked. So it's always a joke about how many people we're blocked by on Twitter. So we can't really see what the hell's going on.
Yeah, check the
link. We're both blocked by this guy, right?
Check this link I just sent you because the graphic is beautiful. And I'm going to put in the show notes. But while you check the link that I just sent, okay, this is what it says. It's Hollywood Reporter, right? And even though he apologized for erasing the black women and all that, he still used it to get himself some press, right? Oh, actually, you know what? Okay, this is what it is. Hollywood Reporter. Here's the title. It's under Women in Entertainment 2016. So it's not even an article about black people. It's in the women issue of Hollywood Reporter. It's a special series of articles called Women in Entertainment 2016. So it basically got co-opted to be a woman's narrative, right? And this picture, it has the picture accompanying the article has Ellen Barkin. Okay, I'm sure you opened it. It has Ellen Barkin, Lena Dunham, and Amy Schumer sitting in the classroom paying rapt attention to this guy, Xavier Bergen. And he's dressed as a teacher, and there's students at a desk. And Ellen Barkin is raising her hand, like, you know, like she wants to ask a question. And Lena Dunham is just riveted, like he's saying something so deep. And Xavier is drawn in the front.
And Amy Schumer has a pen and paper taking notes.
Yeah, Amy Schumer is taking notes. And Xavier Bergen is at a blackboard explaining like white privilege and stuff to them with diagrams. As a teacher, he has a chalk in hand. And this is the title.
And he has this real smug look on his
face. Yes. And it says, filmmaker Xavier Bergen, how it feels to explain Nate Parker to white Hollywood by Xavier Bergen as told to Rebecca Sun. And it's all about how noble he is as, you know, explaining black people to white Hollywood and what, you know, how he's
noble.
Yeah, how noble. He's undertaking this burden as a filmmaker, you know. I mean, he's getting no benefit. As a filmmaker, he's getting no benefit to, you know, cozying up to white Hollywood and selling. There's this thing that they used to, I think they're called indulgences. There used to be this thing that the Catholic Church used to sell back when the Catholic Church was considered its most corrupt. It's one of those things that kind of led people to want to reform the Catholic Church and led to a lot of other alternative Christian churches. But indulgences, it was this thing where the Catholic Church would sell forgiveness for things. Like, you know, they would sell absolute.
Right.
And what a lot of these bougie black access-driven liberals try to do is they try to sell racism indulgences to white liberals. Like, you know, hey, but, you know, they sell it for cheap. They just sell it for, like, you know, some press or some, you know,
it's not
like any of these people's production companies, as far as I know, have given him a great deal. Maybe I'm wrong. Somebody correct me. But, you know, yeah, for a little bit of attention, they're selling these white liberals racial indulgences. So, yeah.
You know what's funny about
that? One last thing. Bergen details how he's given frank lessons about race and gender to Lena Dunham, Ellen Barkin, and Amy Schumer. And then, yeah, and that's all I want to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you were saying?
No, I was saying, you know what's interesting about that point that you raised about them selling those indulgences for cheap, for just for like attention and shit like that? You know, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, they get a lot of flack about, you know, and rightfully so in some circumstances. But I'll say this, one thing about them is in their heyday, you know, they got a lot of tangible shit done. In terms of when somebody would make a racist mistake and they came to capitalize on it, that shit would turn into like jobs.
Yes.
you know, funds going to specific causes and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were hustled away, but they were getting some tangible benefit out of it for Black people.
Yeah, people were accusing them of extorting, but you know, at least they weren't giving it up for cheap.
Somebody wrote a book about that shit, right? Extortion. It was a book about Jesse Jackson.
Yeah. But you know, at least they were like trying to get some real bread, some tangibles, like you said. Like, let me say this. I'm gonna give one quick quote from this article, right? This is what he says. It's him talking to somebody, to the reporter writing the article. I've been using Twitter to tell funny long form stories and also to comment on race, gender, and sexuality issues. You know, of course, it's always everything mixed together, for a long time. Some of my stories have gone viral, and actors and filmmakers I really respect have started following me. As a young Black boy coming out of Mississippi, I never thought that would be possible. Through social media, I've had the opportunity to speak with Lena Dunham, Will Packer, Dana Delaney. Ellen Barkin asked me about Birth of a Nation director Nate Parker's sexual assault controversy, and I replied that Black women more often than not are there for Black men, even when we haven't been good to them. Like, why are you throwing Black men under the bus to some white old liberal? Like these people are just so traitor.
Unironically.
Yes. So it's
unironically, because he himself was accused of doing the very thing that that he throws us under the bus.
Yeah,
about.
Like, instead of helping Black people, organizing Black people, do anything tangible, any material redistribution, anything with Black empowerment, mobilizing Black politics, he's just there looking for. He's doing that thought laundering thing that I was talking about. He's just offering thought laundering services. Like, you know, Ellen Barkin probably wanted to have a free pass, say something bad about Nate Parker, and didn't want Luke raise this. So she's like, hey, Mr. Bergen, can you? Because she knows. She's never going to ask someone like me or you what to think.
Right.
Because we're not going to tell her what she wants to hear. She knows.
Exactly.
This guy's advertised.
That's a great point.
He's going to tell. I'm going to tell you, white liberal, what you want to hear to give you a pass to say what some people might think is racist and punching down. So he's like, no, don't worry. You're not punching down, because Black women tend to be like, why are you going to tell this white woman? Black women more often than not are there for Black men, even when we haven't been good. Even if that was true, that's for us to work out ourselves. White people aren't. Is there a white equivalent to this guy? You know, that's
I struggle to think of one. Shit.
I don't know.
Let me see.
I mean, I hope under Trump, these people just become totally irrelevant. If Hillary won, because what Hillary was going to be for white women, you know, was what Obama was for Black people, you know, which is just a whole bunch of attention. He was going to thrive under Hillary. Like, you know, we've been the age of the white woman. And this thing came out in December 2016, a month after the election. But I bet it was in the mix or done, you know, probably before Trump won. Right. So he was, I think the reason why he was positioning himself.
Yeah, because I remember that issue happening a while back, right? That was.
Yeah. And I bet you what he was trying to do around this time, he was getting ready, because it was going to be the same way was the supposed era of Black liberalism under Obama. It was going to be a golden era of white feminism. He was positioning himself as the Negro whisperer to white feminists. You know, he was ready to have 4 years or 8 years of this hustle. You know, hey, white women, I'm going to be your Negro whisperer to help you and your racial indulgence seller. So I'm sure right now under Trump, you know, this what's this guy gonna do? Nobody's gonna care about, you know.
I wish I wasn't blocked. I would love to see what's going on in his account right now.
Oh,
what hustle he's working on now. I'm reading this article that you I noticed it says here, Amy tweeted that men of color tend to catcall more. Catcalling is a pervasive problem. This is what he said to her, but that's a very racist idea. So I tweeted, hey, this is bad. Why would you say this? What the? Okay. They say this shit all day, every day on Twitter. The black feminists and their black male feminist acolytes, they say this shit all day on Twitter every day. So right there, what you're saying is he's selling her a racial indulgence because he's making it a racist idea that she would say that. But they say the shit all day long on Twitter. So he's letting her know right there, like, hey, I'm going to have to tax you for that. I'm going to call racism on that with, you know, what's up? And then that's what she responded to him. Someone else was using her Twitter account and the three of us should talk on the phone. So, yeah, I mean, you called it. That's a great term. I want to use racial indulgences. That's a great term.
And you know what was interesting about that? They know how to disarm us. Like, and I say this again, and I'm just going to keep dragging it to the ground. White attention is intoxicating to a lot of black people, and it's addictive. It's a drug. And addictions, the hallmarks of addiction are that you compulsively chase it, even like against your own self-interest. You build a tolerance to it, like you need more of it to get the same intoxicating effect, and you go through withdrawal if you don't get it for a while. And I think these people, all three hallmarks of white attention apply to them. And white people, especially liberals, they know this and they weaponize it. It's weaponized white attention. They know that the average black person falls apart with white attention. And by weaponizing it, I mean, like, they're like, okay, there's a group of black people. I'm going to give my attention to this one. And I know the other four are going to get pissed. And I was watching this on a slave movie. And I watched it for the first time. I watched Mandingo and I watched Drum. And I thought they were great movies. I liked them better than 12 Years a Slave. And I realized why they're not popular and why they're considered exploitation. And I think the reason why is, when you watch those movies, the social dynamics in them are still going on today. Whereas when you watch 12 Years a Slave, you can watch it, and as a white person, you won't feel indicted because all the racists are otherized. All the racists are from the past. They're such heinous monsters that just do nothing but abuse. You can watch it and not feel a self-indictment. Whereas with Mandingo and Drum, those movies have a lot of insight to shit that's still going on, both with, like, you know, liberal and conservative type of whites. And one of the things that happened in Drum, this is very interesting, and I think it's kind of like this. The two slaves, right, were fighting. And the reason the slave was fighting, right, was the white slave master's daughter was trying to sleep with one of the slaves. The other slave was telling him, listen, don't let her. She kept trying to show him her breast, try to grab his penis, and the one slave walked in on them, and he's like, listen, don't do it. She's going to get you killed. She's trying to entice you. And then the other guy was like, hey, don't you trust me? I'm not stupid enough to do that. And they got into a fight. You know, her attention caused him to get into a fight, and he's like, look, I'm just looking out for you. I don't want you to die. This is what they do. She's going to tempt you and whatever. Then she's gonna cry rape later. They end up getting into a fight over it. They get bruises on their face, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the master didn't like the slaves fighting because they're damaging each other, like their property. So he goes and chastises the two of them. However, one slave was the house Negro. The other one was the field Negro. So then, and this was very good scene. It's very slick. He goes, okay, you. And he goes to the house Negro. And this is the one that was trying to help the other guy. He was like, okay, you get 10 lashes, right? The next to the field Negro, and the field Negro is like a darker skin too. And he thinks about it, and you see the gears turning in his head. And then he goes, and he has no way of knowing this. He just says it. He goes, and you know what? You started it. You get 40 lashes. He just arbitrarily chose to give him 40 lashes. And then up until this point, they were best friends. At that point, the friendship breaks apart, and then the field Negro keeps saying, why did he get 10 lashes to my 40? And he did, and you could tell the slave master did that on purpose. He deliberately gave that house Negro favorable treatment. And I say favorable in quotation marks because it's still lashes. It's 10 lashes instead of 40. But now the field Negro is fixated on, why did he get 10 and I got 40? Right. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, they understand.
Yeah, that plays on a lot of things, man.
Yeah. They understand what they're doing. He knew by doing that he was going to divide them. And then, yeah, I think that still goes on today. That's that same thing that's happening with Xavier Burgeon and those black feminists who, at one point, they were all on the united front, dragging Lena Dunham and high-fiving each other and yassing. And, you know, once that happened, the next day was just nothing about getting mad at Xavier for getting access to these white women. And why aren't they getting access? Why aren't you talking to us?
Yeah, that's amazing. And you see that happen in real life every day. I'm going to have to watch that movie now. I've been reluctant to watch it after watching Goodbye, Uncle Tom.
Oh, Goodbye, Uncle Tom.
You know, I was kind of reluctant to watch it. Yeah, I was kind of reluctant to watch some of those other films from that era, but you know, I'm gonna go ahead and check it out. That sounds like a real powerful scene. It's pretty poignant.
Yeah, I will say this: it's not as wrenching as Goodbye, Uncle Tom. Goodbye, Uncle Tom makes you want to vomit in how explicit it is and how gruesome it is. Even though I love Goodbye, Uncle Tom, to me, it's one of my favorite movies because I think it's kind of honest in how exploitative it is. Like, I feel like it should make you sick if you're going to watch about slavery, but.
So, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But,
I just feel like it's only so much of that shit that you can.
Oh, for sure.
Put into your being.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I couldn't sleep after watching Goodbye, Uncle Tom.
Yeah, me neither. That was pretty damn wrenching. But yeah, I think that, you hit on everything, man. That was the very salient point, about using that and making it be relevant for today, using film. And that's something Neely Fuller discusses a lot in his lessons, where he talks about when you watch movies, don't just watch them to be entertained, but watch movies for the lessons that you can learn that are applicable to your real life situation.
Yes, yes.
You know, so if you're going to
watch it for the insight, right, use not it for the distraction.
Yeah, right. For the insight, not the distraction. That was a very good point that you brought up about that and how they use it to this very day to divide black people. Because I'm thinking in my head right now of several scenarios that happened, you know, with our organization within the last year and a half, that where that scenario was actually what ended up dividing our group.
Yeah, it's a parents organization, right? I'm not going to ask you to get specific because I don't want to get you in trouble. But
I won't get too specific about it. But yeah, it's a parent organization that you know, with the goal of helping to close the achievement gap educationally with black students that exists, especially in the state of California. We're basically behind in every single category, and we try to do a lot of work in the community to focus on helping to close that achievement gap. And at one particular point in time, we had a lot. I won't go too far into it because I know I'm looking at the time. But just to kind of summarize it, you know, we had a united front. A lot of black parents were involved. My wife is the chairperson of the organization. I was the vice chairperson of the organization. And we had a white principal who came in. And at first he was on board with everything that we were doing. And when things got contentious between my wife and I and him, he handpicked one of our closest allies, brung her into his office and had a personal conversation with her about some things that he was concerned about. At the time, she needed a job. And so, you know, she was in a vulnerable position and he offered her a position. If she did certain things, and then she came and tried to talk to us about it, we were kind of upset that she would even sit down with him alone in that context to have a conversation about shit that he didn't like that we were doing. We felt like she shouldn't have been involved in that situation. She should have told him if she was on code that, you know, that's something you need to have a private discussion with them about instead of sitting there and acting as a mouthpiece. And no, he knows exactly what he was doing. And so he kind of put the job position on the table with the implication being that if you do this for me, little quid pro quo, you know, this would be on the table for you. And her being in that vulnerable position, she took the bait and basically spent, you know, it got heated. And that particular person spent the last year basically sabotaging everything that we were trying to do. We spent the whole we had a lot of momentum going into last year. And, you know, I'm really, it really pisses me off when I start thinking about this. But we had a lot of momentum going into the last school year. And we just pissed it all away because we spent most of the year fighting amongst ourselves. And, you know,
oh, just, that's tragic. That's a shame.
Yeah.
That's a shame. And it's so so predictable.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, there was something that you wanted to bring up. That there are these three women defending Trump after the after that whole Charlottesville mess, and it was two black women and a white woman, and you know, they were saying it's not about black versus white, it's about left versus right, and yeah, it was some real fuckery. I don't know where they found these
fuckery going on in that article. Yeah, it's on CBSnews.com. There was an article, and the headline is, "I think for myself, Trump voters voiced their support despite Charlottesville comments." And then, of course, they get two black women and they're seated on either side of a white woman. And then, so they're talking about how they still support Trump, regardless of what he said about Charlottesville. The white lady I found interesting, she said, "We're not looking for someone charming. We are looking for a man who knows how to turn things around. And he's got a track record of turning things around." So she used it as a sort of, you know, she tried to make it seem like it was just business. It was strictly business. "I don't want somebody that's lovey-dovey. I don't want somebody to make me feel good. I want somebody who gets shit done." And then one of the other black women, she said, "I don't look at him as my pastor or my moral leader. I look at him as the leader as it relates to governmental issues," right? So then there's this other one who really, really, just really went in. So even the one black lady that is on the left side of this woman, she kept her remarks relatively short. Now, I don't know how this was edited, so she could have said a lot more, I'm not sure. But there's this one, her name is Lucretia Hughes, and she provides the bulk of the commentary. They ask her about the Confederate monuments. She says, "Oh, those are part of our history. I wasn't born back then. You wasn't either. So why is that affecting us? If anything, we should grow and learn from it." And here we go. "Just like Martin Luther King said, you don't judge people by the color of their skin. You base that on their character." And I know that you had some interesting insights about that, the ubiquitous Martin Luther King quote that everybody likes to use, that everybody seems to know.
People think that Martin Luther King just did nothing. Like, his whole platform was about nothing but holding hands with white people. And they've done such a good job of, you know, after his death, like, you know, changing the narrative. Like, you just think this guy was just about nothing but being near white people and not thinking about race. You know, like, the whole don't judge people by the color of the skin, base it on their character. Like, they think all he did was do the I Have a Dream speech, and that all he wanted to do was just to have no one talk and think about race. And he had so many radical speeches. He had things like, and he kept getting more radical near the end. He said things like, "I was chasing integration, but I fear I may have advocated my people to integrate into a burning house." And he talked about, when one of his last speeches was about reparations, and he said, "We're coming for our check." So he wasn't somebody that was race blind or race neutral. If you're advocating for black reparations, you know, you're not advocating for a colorblind society where nobody notices the color of your skin. And the other thing is, if you have to ignore the color of someone's skin to treat them right, you're basically reinforcing racism. Like, what do you?
That's a great point.
What does that even mean? Like, I can look past your skin color. You shouldn't have to look past somebody's skin color to treat them with basic.
Like, if we're all humans, right? If we're all humans and we're all Americans, what the hell are you having to look past? It should be an innate response to us being fellow Americans.
Yeah. Martin Luther King didn't want you to ignore that he was black. He wouldn't tell you to just pretend I'm not black, so that, you know, to treat me well. Like, you know, they've done such a good job in just getting not just white people, but black people. Because this is a black woman that said this.
just believe in this sanitized version of him. And one thing I like to put out to the audience, because I would love to get a guest that's a scholar and knowledgeable on Martin Luther King's radical side. If you have any recommendations, please let me know. I will try to get them on, because that's, I think, is a very good topic, like the whitewashing, no pun intended, of Martin Luther King. Yeah, but...
You know what?
Yeah.
I wanted to draw an analogy to that and what happens in Christianity as well, because I noticed that this is a learned response. Especially when Black people do this. And I noticed that a lot of people do that with regards to Christianity too. They'll use specific passages about turning the other cheek, or the one passage that everybody knows, the one scripture that everybody knows about, not judging someone, you know, judge not, lest you be judged.
Yes.
Everybody seems to know that. And it's a response to specific stimuli that they don't want, that disturbs them. So they automatically use those terms to deflect with what's causing them the tension. And this Dr. Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech quote that everybody seems to know, it's the same kind of principle. This is a learned response that a lot of Black people have. And white people use it as a rebuke to Black people. And Black people use it as a shield against other more radical minded Black people. I noticed that it's used in different contexts with the different people. Whites use it as a rebuke, or as a, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King said, not the content of the character,
yep,
but not the color of the skin, but the content of the character. And they're using it to rebuke Black people a lot of times. And then when Black people use it, they're kind of using it as a shield. You know, like this lady is doing right here. She's using it as a defense mechanism. I just find that very interesting. I would like to have like a psychologist on or something who understands like how behaviors are taught to groups and shit like that.
In order to
garner specific types of responses.
It's almost a mantra. Like, you know, it's just something that you just recite unthinkingly almost, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And who teaches? Because they don't have specific classes that teaches you this shit. Like, it doesn't happen. It happens like through osmosis or something.
Yeah,
it's
crazy. Or on Martin Luther King Day, when they have all a day full of Martin Luther King specials, and they just, you know, make it seem like he was just somebody that just wanted Black people to hug white people and white people to hug them back for 10 years. That was his whole thing. Like, you know, there's a whole bunch of ways where people kind of absorb this message, you know. It's very interesting how it happened.
It really is.
The very last thing I'd like to talk about before we go, this is not something I even really want to discuss. I just kind of want to just link to it out there. There's an article in New York Times today called Circling the Square of President Trump's Relationship with Race by Yamiche Alcindor and Maggie Haberman. And it's talking about Donald Trump's problematic past with Black people. And it mentions something that I didn't even know, that he dated a Black model. She's biracial, but biracial, Black-white, it seems, Kara Young, for 2 years in the 90s. I just think it's very interesting because, you know, a lot of people, both white and Black, love to say that dating a Black person does not make you, is proof that you're not racist. I just find it interesting that Trump, one person that almost everyone seems able to agree is racist, even establishment Republicans, dated a Black woman for 2 years.
So it surprises me that he had a Black girlfriend, but at the same time, it doesn't surprise me because that's a part of the tool book. And they can, one of the things that, we keep going back to Neely Fuller, but, you know, he discusses how sexual access with whites is one of the weapons that they use to keep Black people confused about race. They're never confused about sexual interact people, Black people, but it muddies the waters for us when it comes to how we look at specific racial issues in the country. And like, you even see that with a lot of these discussions about interracial dating in general. If you notice, it's Black people who really, really get up in arms and passionate about the ability to date interracially. A lot of white people will chime.
I made this term that I came up with, and I call it bills, and that's like bourgeois interpersonal lifestyle liberalism. That's what I call them. I call them bills, because their racism is never about systems. It's about their interpersonal stuff. Like, oh, my white friend offended me with microaggressions. Racism is still bad because, you know, what happens when I go out with my white friends, or right. I'm dating my white boyfriend and he says something racially insensitive. You know, racism must stop. Or, you know, I went with my white girlfriend to her in-law's house and it said something bad. Like basically racism is bad because it's messing with their bourgeois lifestyle. It's making it's making their assimilation go less than smooth. And racism is just all about a bunch of interpersonal interactions. There's just a bunch of individual interactions that everyone in this needs a really good etiquette lesson. And that's what racism is, just a lot of lack of etiquette, you know? And that's where I think a lot of this comes from, is when somebody throws a monkey wrench in the idea of making it, because everything's about making their assimilation as smooth as possible. And the ultimate assimilation is to have a white partner. So remember when Umar Johnson went on The Breakfast Club and he said bad things about having a white partner and trying to fight for black rights? And he said a lot of things in that article, and that's the one they zeroed in on that, and went crazy, the controversy over that. Like, and it basically came down to, how dare you say we can't date white people? Like, people were fighting angry over it, and he said so many provocative things in that article. Like, whether you agree with it or not, I just found it fascinating the disproportionate amount of attention that got, whether you think it's right or wrong. Like, there were a lot of things that you could have taken issue with, and it was interesting that, like, 90% of the outrage was geared toward that 5 minutes of a one-hour interview.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, it's sex is a powerful driving force, man, and I think a lot of times that, I don't want to play into specific stereotypes regarding black people, but I think a lot of times, man, we have this overemphasis on sex, man, and sexual access that just drives us to the point of irrationality. So when we have these discussions about racial issues and sexual politics and things like that, we can't even think clearly about it because we're thinking, oh, shit, you mean to tell me I'm not going to lay up and have sex with my white girlfriend or my white boyfriend, instead of looking at it in terms of how the system is so imbalanced that that relationship actually could be unhealthy for you and your children in the long term, unless specific things happens to address that imbalance. They just go crazy thinking lack of having that sexual access, man. And it's always fascinating.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why I say I like Mandingo and drums so much, because that whole sexual access thing is a big part of the story, and the dynamics are just so creepily echoed today still that it talks about, absolutely. You know? Yeah, and, but...
Take it back to that art really quick. I just wanted to take it back to that article that about Kara Young. Her name is Kara Young, and like you said, she's a model. And she dated Donald Trump for 2 years before he got married to Melania Trump. She says she never noticed him bring up anything racial or anything like that. And two things jumped out to me with that. Number one is, a lot of black people's views on race are so limited to begin with that they can't recognize the more subtle racism that happens. You know, racism, yes. when it's being used in a way that is not as overt, when it's used for housing discrimination, denial of loans.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And all that stuff is systemic. Like, you know, all they think about is the interpersonal and the individual atomized interactions. Yeah,
exactly. So what she's saying is, she's never heard him say nigger or anything like that. And I think what a lot of people forget about Donald Trump, I know that we look at his Twitter, he has diary of the mouth at times. People forget that this guy, I believe there was an article that came out about him a while back that said he never sent an email in his life, basically. Everything that he does is through hand delivery. He doesn't do emails or anything like that. So behind all of that bluster, is a very disciplined business person, and he would not slip up and say anything disparaging about black people to a black girlfriend, you know, his black piece of ass.
Yeah.
Excuse my language.
Yeah.
Crass, but that's what it is. He's a very disciplined guy. Yeah. Don't let that Twitter account fool
for sure.
You know,
I think he might have dementia, and I think that might be why he's slipping. But yeah, I mean, he used to be a very lucid person. We see his interviews. He was still self-aggrandizing and narcissistic, but he was very lucid and composed. So yeah, back then I could totally see him. But yeah, I think it's two things that she missed, and it's the same thing that we're talking about. She missed the systemic things, like, you know, maybe he wasn't being overtly racist and calling her like a nigger bitch, but he was perpetuating systemic racism with his housing suits, his employment practices, etc. His championing of the locking up of the Central Park Five and taking out ads, right. You know, promoting the jail industrial, the prison industrial complex. So she's ignoring the systemic things. And then she's also thinking of it as a civility level. He's never using a slur against me. Right. Yeah. So as long as he's not being incivil, and as long as, you know, he's just doing systemic stuff, but not one-on-one stuff, he's not really a racist. And it's we don't really have the right training, you know, we don't really have the right discipline to get it. And it makes sense, because who are we going to get it from? All we want to do is go to white schools. That's what integration is about. You know, we want to go to white schools with white curriculum makers and white principals. And we kind of have no choice, because the black schools a lot of the times are a mess. But look who's in charge of educating us. It's not easy to come out with a different worldview.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we're going to have to make that change, because, you know, if we continue to look for racism in the overt fashion, you know, calling someone a nigger, shooting people for being black, the shit that goes on with the police in the country, those are the more overt forms of racism. And those are the ones that tend to make you fall asleep when it comes to the more covert forms of racism, the ones that affect us on a systemic level.
Yes.
And keep us consistently at the bottom of the barrel for years and years.
And the ones that gnaw at our self-esteem, because, you know, the overt ones might wake you up and make you fight against it, but the little microaggressions, those little covert ones, those are the ones that kind of undermine your self-image. So the covert interpersonal reactions and the systemic ones, you know, I think are actually the two more dangerous ones than the overt ones. The overt ones make you fight. Like, you know, you see tons of YouTube videos of people getting fighting mad over being called a name, you know? But yeah, I think we I think we have to wrap it up, because we're at 1.5 hours. Yeah. But I mean, I think we covered.
This could have easily been a 2 hour show.
We covered a lot of ground, though, man. I want to say something. We're a little bit behind on episodes. I realize that we're going to be playing catch up over the next couple of weeks. So, you know, don't worry about that. Every now and then real life gets in the way, but we always try to get back on schedule. So there'll be some extra episodes, more than usual, coming out in the coming weeks to get us back on schedule. And also, I think that's it. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I'm going to just keep my eye on this situation that's going on in Boston and see what comes about from this. Hopefully everything goes as peacefully as possible, and no one ends up seriously injured or killed. And thoughts and prayers to we didn't get a chance to address it last week because it happened. We wrapped up the show before we had a chance to see what happened with the Heather.
Her family, man. She really showed and proved. I mean, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely the kind of ally that I would not mind having, you know, as we go.
Thank you for bringing it up. I'm so glad. You're right. We did not, we're not able to address her last time because it just happened. But yeah, that was very tragic. And, you know,
Definitely thoughts and prayers to her family.